Now to CBS for the World Tonight with Douglas Edwards.
President Nixon named a new special Watergate prosecutor today, but it isn't at all certain that this will satisfy his critics on Capitol Hill. The new prosecutor is Leon Jaworski. He's a Texas lawyer, a friend of John Connolly, a conservative law and order Democrat. Acting Attorney General Robert Bork made the announcement and tried to reassure the critics.
He has been promised the full cooperation of the executive branch in the pursuit of his investigations. Should he disagree with the decision of the administration with regard to the release of presidential documents, there will be no restrictions placed on his freedom of action. The president has given his personal assurance that he will not exercise his constitutional powers. With regard to the special prosecutor, without first consulting the majority and minority leaders and chairman and ranking members of the judiciary committees of the Senate and the House, and ascertaining that their consensus is in accord with his proposed action.
You'll remember that Bork is the man who bowed to President Nixon's directive and fired Archibald Cox. Bork said today he doesn't expect any disagreement with Jaworski, but if there is, the agreement on method of operation is supposed to take care of that. Walter Cronkite talked to Jaworski today and asked the key question.
Mr. Cox has said that he thought he came to the end of the rope, as it were, in this matter when he began to request materials that the White House was reluctant to surrender to him, and he mentioned particularly notes and memoranda of, I believe he said, both Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Now, if that is true, how are you going to proceed? Aren't you going to need the same materials that he thought he needed?
I have no way of passing on whether I will need the same materials. There's no doubt for what I'll need some. And whatever I feel that I need, I'm going to request. And if they're essential to the prosecution, of course, and I wouldn't request them without so believing, then I'm going to insist upon their being produced. And if they're not produced, then I'm going to proceed to get them, because I am not precluded under my arrangement from taking any action that I deem appropriate and necessary.
Jaworski told Walter Cronkite that he hasn't talked personally with Mr. Nixon, that it's fair to say that neither of them considered it appropriate to do so. Just before Bork announced the appointment of Jaworski as special prosecutor, President Nixon personally announced the worst-kept secret of the year. He's nominating Senator William Saxby to succeed Bork in the post of Attorney General. And the president says Saxby is eminently qualified.
Not only is he eminently qualified, but he is an individual who wants to take this position and to do everything that he possibly can to serve the nation as the first lawyer in the nation. As a matter of fact, as you know, Bill Saxby had already indicated that he wasn't going to run for the Senate again in Ohio this year and that he wanted to practice law. So I've given him the opportunity, with the Senate's consent, which I think will be overwhelming, to head the largest law firm in America, the Department of Justice.
There was a little dig at the way Saxby has been announcing the news in advance, and then Saxby responded in his usual outspoken style.
I do understand and comprehend the difficult times that I feel that our country is in, a crisis of leadership. I believe that I can help solve this problem. I think everyone in this country wants to get back to routine affairs and the very difficult things that we have to settle both nationally and internationally.
Saxby conceded that he's anxious to have the job, and Mrs. Saxby says that if anybody can straighten out the Justice Department, Bill can. For the first time in American history, a vice presidential candidate went to Capitol Hill today to be questioned on his fitness to occupy a post one heartbeat from the presidency. The man, of course, Gerald Ford, Republican congressman from Michigan. Barry Serafin covered the hearings of the Senate Rules Committee.
Ford came to the historic hearing billed as the most investigated individual ever considered for such an office, but a good deal of the questioning centered on current issues related to Watergate. Asked about executive privilege, for example, the Michigan congressman said presidential documents should be turned over by the White House if they do not bear on national security matters, and are believed to have a bearing on criminal matters. Ford backed President Nixon's stand that a special Watergate prosecutor be appointed by the White House and insisted there were adequate safeguards for an independent investigation. He also said he thought the impeachment inquiry in the House should go forward.
Resolutions have been introduced in the House. They have been referred to the Committee on Judiciary. I'm told that that committee intends to carry on its assigned responsibility. They only make a recommendation, and then the House itself has to vote on it. I think that's the way to clear the air.
On other matters, Ford said he had never wrongfully received or been improperly influenced by financial contributions. He also flatly denied reports indicating that he had been treated by a psychiatrist. The vice presidential nominee called himself disgustingly sane. In a phrase reminiscent of one used by President Nixon a few days ago, said his mental ability gets better under pressure. There was little pressure from the committee today, but Ford was asked to return Monday to answer more questions. Barry Serafin, CBS News, Washington.
President Nixon met with Israel's prime minister today and then unexpectedly flew to Key Biscayne, so unexpectedly that the usual press contingent couldn't get to the plane in time. Prime Minister Golda Meir held a news conference after meeting with Mr. Nixon, and Marvin Kalb reports.
Mrs. Meir met first with Secretary Kissinger and then with the president and finally with the press. It was then that she ruled out an Israeli pullback from the West Bank of the Suez Canal unless that results from direct negotiations between Israel and Egypt. She also denied there has been any American pressure, and she proposed for the first time straightening out the ceasefire line of October 22nd. Few details. But first and foremost, for her and Israel, is a deal on getting back prisoners of war.
For Israel, this is almost priority number one. Mainly the wounded prisoners, and I'm speaking now not only of Egypt, we are even more concerned about Syria because of very tragic experiences that we've had with our prisoners in Syria from former battles. But they must give us the list of all prisoners of war.
She tried putting the best face on Israel's still strained relations with Washington, but perhaps that was natural for a politician with trouble back home. Marvin Kalb, CBS News, Washington.
The Cost of Living Council has given permission for an increase in the retail price of gasoline and home heating oil, effective today, one that will match increases in wholesale prices. Richard Threlkeld reports on another fuel crisis.
In San Francisco, if you were planning to take Pacific Southwest Airlines 10 p.m. commuter to Los Angeles, forget it. Effective today. And you can forget Transworld's midday flight to Boston, too. Here and all over the country, the airlines are scratching flights, 10 to 15% of them in most cases, and pulling their gas-eating jumbo jets off the line on others. There's just not enough jet fuel to go around, so the government's ordered all the airlines to use no more fuel than they did last year. So that means fewer flights and fewer seats. Aside from the inconvenience, the cutback is really going to hurt airline employees, hundreds of whom will have to be laid off. The only advice the airlines have for passengers is, before you go to the airport, check first to make sure you've got an airplane. Richard Threlkeld, CBS News, San Francisco.
Stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed around 949, down 7.75. The average price per share was down 22 cents on the New York Exchange, up 4 cents on the American. And that's the financial side of this world tonight. It was a busy day in Washington, and not the least of the stories came from Judge John Sirica and his hearings on the missing Watergate tapes. Hal Walker reports.
Today's explanation of why there is no recording of the April 15th conversation between John Dean and the president differed slightly from that offered in yesterday's hearing before Judge Sirica. Yesterday, White House counsel Fred Buzhardt suggested that the Sunday conversation was not recorded because of a faulty time. It became clear that the system itself was allegedly at fault. Buzhardt explained to reporters his version of what happened.
The tape that was operative was a six-hour tape. It ran on Saturday, it ran on Sunday, and there were more than 6 hours of conversation. The tape ended. There was no system to have a backup tape.
Why didn't anyone think to find out if all these subpoena tapes existed?
There was no cause to. We thought we were going to win the suit, and we'd never have to bother with them. We presumed that the conversations were there.
Testimony today revealed that the April 15th tape in question was among those checked out of its locked White House safe as long ago as mid-July. about the time former 8HR Haldeman has testified he took some tapes home to review them for the president. The hearing continues tomorrow. Hal Walker, CBS News, Washington.
Leslie Stahl has a report now on a memo released today by Senator Weicker.
After a meeting with the three television network chiefs, former White House aide Charles Colson wrote a memo in which he said, quote, "The harder I press them, CBS and NBC, the more accommodating, cordial, and almost apologetic they became." The September 1970 memo from Colson to H.R. Haldeman said, quote, "To my surprise, CBS did not deny that the news had been slanted against us. According to Colson, CBS Chairman William Paley merely said that every administration has felt the same way and that we have been slower in coming to them to complain than our predecessors." On the question of allowing answers to presidential speeches, Colson wrote, quote, "In this regard, ABC will do anything we want." Colson recommended asking the Federal Communications Commission for an interpretive ruling on the role of the president when he uses television, quote, "as soon as we have a majority on the commission." Colson commented this would, of course, have an inhibiting impact on the networks. Leslie Stahl, CBS News, Washington.
CBS Board Chairman William S. Paley said tonight that CBS News judgment will never yield to outside influences, and CBS management has always upheld the integrity of CBS News. The World Tonight continues after this message.
All right, today we're going to make applesauce. All right, girls? Yeah.
Okay, keep your head back, Deidre. Don't depend on me, depend on Deidre.
You pin them this way with the pins going out, okay?
Let's play some C's together and hear how they sound.
Are you all right?
No.
People working with girls' clubs can make a difference. This is Carol Burnett asking you to help your local girls' club or write to Girls Clubs of America, Box 35, Grand Central Station, New York, 10017, to help get one started. You can make a difference.
Want
to
be a
yep. Coach, you
know
what you have to do?
Good luck.
All that science, all that
We have two reports from the Middle East tonight, and neither of them sounds very encouraging for a peace settlement. We hear first from Bruno Wassertal in Tel Aviv.
Israeli and Egyptian forces fought briefly today in a clash around the Third Army's northern perimeter east of the Great Bitter Lake. The clash was over in an hour and seemed to be one of a series of fitful outbreaks of shooting that have punctuated the Middle East ceasefire now in its second week. Meanwhile, in the city of Suez, where Israeli, Egyptian, and UN forces rub shoulders, 65 of the 125 trucks bringing non-military supplies to the Egyptian Third Army had already been offloaded. According to eyewitness reports, the atmosphere there didn't seem very bellicose, and there was even some informal fraternization between Israeli and Egyptian soldiers, the talk tending to drift to the subjects of family life and army pay. But in Israel itself, the home front still seemed angry and bitter that the prisoner of war problem, the most goading issue in Israel today, still remains unresolved. Bruno Wassertal for CBS News in Tel Aviv.
CBS News correspondent John Sheehan is covering the UN peacekeeping operation from his base in Cairo and reports considerable difficulty with that.
The United Nations peacekeeping force here in Egypt is still a thin line of men trying to do an almost impossible job. The soldiers come from Austria, Sweden, Finland, and Ireland. So far, there are just 789 of them here. They have to cover more than 100 miles of front line. They're out there somewhere between the Egyptians and the Israelis, and they're hoping that help arrives soon. About 1,500 more UN soldiers are said to be on the way, but UN officials here in Cairo can't say for sure when the reinforcements will arrive. I've talked with a few of the UN troops. Some told me they've been in uniform 24 hours a day since they got here. When they're at the front, they're sometimes out of contact because their radios aren't powerful enough. And they're getting shot at, they say, not all the time, but occasionally and unexpectedly. And most times, they can't tell which side is doing the shooting. John Sheehan, CBS News, Cairo.
That's the World Tonight, Thursday, November 1st. This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News.
Weather, windy with cloudy periods and a chance of brief showers tonight, a low about 40. Variable cloudiness and a chance of a few showers tomorrow and tomorrow night. A high near 50, a low tomorrow night 35 to 40. Mostly cloudy on Saturday with a high near 50. Buffalo temperature 49 degrees.
This is Walter Cronkite reporting with news and analysis on the CBS radio network. Last Monday, presidential spokesman Gerald Warren told reporters that those controversial tape recordings, the tapes Mr. Nixon had finally decided to turn over to the courts to avert a major constitutional confrontation, were now under the president's personal physical control. For some reason, Warren did not mention what presidential counsel Fred Buzhardt has since told federal judge John Sirica, that two of the nine recordings in question were missing for several weeks, and that a day or two before Warren spoke, Buzhardt had concluded that those two key conversations had never been recorded at all. A closer look in a moment.
Dinner time is a together time. At least that's how we think at Holiday Inn restaurants. It's a time for you to be together with a group of friends, or just you dining together with someone you love. A time to get together over a good meal in an atmosphere that says a good time. So the next time you're dining out, get together with Holiday Inn. Good food, good friends, together.
Together with you.
Investigators believe the conversations in the two missing tapes, or non-tapes, were critical evidence of how much President Nixon knew about the Watergate break-in and whether he was involved in the cover-up. The first of the two was a phone call on June 20, 1972, just 3 days after the abortive burglary, from the president to John Mitchell, who'd recently retired as attorney general to manage the president's re-election campaign. According to Mitchell's testimony to the Senate Watergate Committee, this was the only time the president asked him directly for the facts about the break-in. Mitchell maintains he couldn't tell the president anything because he didn't know anything at the time. Instead, he testified he apologized for his ignorance. But two of Mitchell's aides, Jeb Magruder and Fred LaRue, have testified that the day before the Nixon-Mitchell phone call, Mitchell had spoken to them about destroying written reports of Watergate wiretaps. A tape recording of the Nixon-Mitchell phone call, in other words, might have resolved whether or not Mitchell really knew the whole story and whether he quickly told it to the president. The second conversation was an hour-long meeting at the Executive Office Building between Mr. Nixon and John Dean, this April 15th, just 2 weeks before the president discharged Dean as White House counsel. In the Senate hearings, Dean testified that at this meeting, the president, though cordial, asked such leading questions that Dean suspected he was being recorded. He said the president declared he'd only been joking when he previously discussed the possibility of raising $1 million in hush money for the Watergate defendants. Dean also said that at one point the president lowered his voice and admitted he'd probably been foolish in discussing clemency for Watergate defendant Howard Hunt with former presidential counsel Charles Colson. Now, Mr. Nixon, on his May 22nd statement, said, quote, "At no time did I authorize about any offer of executive clemency for the Watergate defendants." Furthermore, former presidential assistant Bob Haldeman has testified that at a meeting in March between the president, Haldeman, and Dean, instead of joking about $1 million hush fund, the president said it would be wrong. A tape of the Nixon-Dean meeting on April 15th, in other words, would have gone a long way in helping resolve the conflicting accounts of the president's role, if any, in the cover-up. But the Nixon to Mitchell phone call, we're now told, was made from a White House phone that wasn't linked up to the recording system. And the Nixon-Dean meeting was unrecorded because the tape on the machine ran out before the evening meeting started and a backup machine failed to turn on. Although various administration figures, including the president, have since listened to at least some of the tapes, Buzhardt says it was only last weekend that he determined that these two conversations never were recorded. This by way of explanation of why the administration let us think they were recorded,
suddenly reported otherwise only when the tapes finally seemed headed for a grand jury. Apparently accepting the official explanation, Senate Republican leader Hugh Scott points out that this machine age isn't always perfect. But to many other suspicious congressmen, Republicans and Democrats alike, these technical failures, if that's what they were, could not have come at a worse time for an administration with extreme credibility problems. As another Republican senator, conservative James Buckley, puts it, this disclosure has dramatically shifted the burden of proof to President Nixon. If he fails to meet it, Buckley continues, we are faced with a political crisis of the most profoundly disturbing proportion.
Now this commercial message. Newsweek magazine calls it the most devastating assault any president has endured in a century. Virtually all his former staff or friends resigned or have been fired. Noise of impeachment grows louder. Credibility at an all-time low. Yet the president seems to get bolder with every setback. What's on those tapes? What did Newsweek discover in the president's income tax returns that made news?